Good evening, good evening. Everyone's attention, please. Hello? Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Donatich. I'm the director of Yale University Press, and I'm pleased to welcome you tonight to this inauguration of the Yale Drama Series. It gives me a great pleasure to kick off this annual event, a prize, a collaboration between the Yale University Press, the Yale Repertory Theater, and made possible through the generosity of the David C. Horn Foundation and the True Vision of Francine Horn. First, I want to tell you a little story. Back in 1919, when the world was still kind of reeling from the bloody apocalypse that was World War I, the press began a new series called the Yale Series of Younger Poets. It was a very prestigious award and has grown much more prestigious during the years, launching the careers of people like W.S. Merwin, John Hollander, and John Ashbery. We recently celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Yale Younger Poets series, and we thought, okay, we've done our share of bringing public light and accolade to perhaps the most neglected writers in the universe. And then we thought of playwrights, and we thought that something had to be done. The Yale Drama Series supports emerging playwrights in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Ireland. The winner of the annual competition is awarded an annual prize of $10,000. A publication in hardcover and softcover by the Yale University Press, and a staged reading in the Yale Repertory Theater. In this first year of the prize, we received over 500, nearly 600 submissions, which was an impressive debut, certainly, and that number will increase over the years. A few of them, I must admit, were silly enough to deserve staged readings at our Christmas party. But then there were more than just a few that were good enough to read and reread. Three of those playwrights chosen personally by Edward Albee are with us tonight, and I'll leave it to him to say the good things about the winner. With that, I would like to introduce Mercedes Ruhl, who certainly needs no introduction, but I don't think she'd mind if we reminded ourselves that she won a Tony Award for Lost in Yonkers, an Academy Award for The Fisher King, and she's also starred most recently in Edward Albee's The Goat or Who is Sylvia. Ladies and gentlemen, Mercedes Ruhl.
Thank you. In an interview shortly before the first preview of his play, The Goat, Edward Albee was reported to have said, "With any luck, there will be people standing up, shaking their fists at the performance, and throwing things at the stage. I hope so." Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, he did not share that sentiment with us, the performers. And such was the impassioned and, yes, in some cases, enraged response of the audience that night, particularly, it seemed to me, on my final entrance, but maybe that's just me, that I was inspired, just prior to that entrance in the second preview, to turn to the stage manager and give the ancient Roman gladiatorial salutation, "We who are about to die, salute you." Manifestly, I did not die, but apparently the option was closer than either I or my co-star, Bill Pullman, suspected, but to that in a moment. Each night, a little posse of people would rush to our dressing room, our dressing rooms, after the performance, and they generally divided into two groups. The first came back with eyes luminous, a luminosity about them, suggesting that they had had that experience peculiar to the theater, to great theater, and I have had this myself, and it is as marvelous as it is rare when, in a darkened auditorium, the boundaries of your consciousness suddenly, involuntarily expand, and you find yourself deciding to change your life right there, right in the middle of the second act. Others came back with eyes bright with pure rage, suggesting they were ready to kill the actors, draw and quarter the playwright, and set fire to the theater. Absolutely no one came back and led with the sentence, "So where shall we have supper tonight?" The rage gang was fascinating, very alive, but troubling. There were death threats to Bill. He was given a bodyguard, too. I was very concerned for him for a while, but then I began to wonder Where are my death threats? Each night, I left the theater alone, a few paces behind Bill and his entourage of NYPD Blue. And that hurt. Finally, someone tacked a half-hearted threat to me at the end of a much more colorful one to Bill in an email, and I was at last accorded a rather bored-looking couple of bodyguards for 2 weeks. During this time, I said to Edward, "Edward, do you realize that every night we actors risk our lives in the service of your play?" And he responded without taking so much as a beat, "Mercedes, do you realize that every night I risk my play in the service of your acting?" The GOAT was a challenging experience on both sides of the footlights. It has at its heart, as does Virginia Woolf, a figure that is both real and symbolic and functions on both levels at the same time. That's hard stuff. On the one hand, a man has fallen in love with an animal. There it is. Walt Whitman, "I think I could turn and live with animals. They're so placid and self-contained." It happens. What's not to love? On the other hand, the goat is a symbol, an idea, a door through which one might walk into the shadow part of one's own consciousness, and putting on the lights there, find the truth that's been waiting for you all along. Only a writer who is unbought, unbought by commerce, unbought by fame, can lead you there, to that place. It is this quality of being and remaining unbought that seems, in the transcripts that I have read, to be at the heart of Edward's message to young playwrights, to beginning playwrights, to mature playwrights, to playwrights, where is he, who find themselves writing great plays in the middle of their lives. A great writer, he has said, will take a fact and transform it into the truth. A bad writer will in all likelihood do just the opposite. It is the truth that we turn to for dear life in art. It is a beacon in times of darkness when the state or the church or the collective we have succumbed to greed, to fear, and to mendacity. So what if your actors get death threats? We're tough. We can take it. Edward seems to wear the courage required for this business very casually as he appears to weave his truth into the dazzling music of his language, entertaining as he instructs, instructing as he entertains. Teach us to be unbought. Stay among us for a long time, sir. You are the music while the music lasts. Ladies and gentlemen, Edward Albee.
If you ever wondered why the really, really, really good actresses are not only talented on stage but also terribly intelligent people, I think you just got some proof of that. I must read some of this. It's a bit too long to have pretended to have memorized. I'm not certain, necessarily, that the play which I've chosen to win this inaugural year's Yale Drama Series and the accompanying David C. Horn Prize, co-sponsored by Yale University Press and the Yale Repertory Theater, is necessarily the best play of the 508 plays submitted. I'm pretty damn sure of it. But let me tell you why I'm not totally sure of it. Simply, I did not read all 508 plays. There are reasons for this, primarily my sanity. I've judged enough play contests and read enough new plays generally to know that maybe 1 in 20 of the plays submitted to any contest is worth the reading, and that we playwrights are in sufficient despair over the condition of the theater without having our tenuous grasp on the life force diminished by the pummelings of the mediocre and the truly hopeless. What to do? Well, what I did was choose six young theater professionals, playwrights mostly, whose work and minds I respect, and whose objectivity I trust, to winnow the pile down to a relative precious few, and have me read them thoroughly and carefully. This is not an ideal solution, but what is one to do? There is no ideal solution. There's no perfect way around 508 scripts and one final judge. But I feel we solved it as wisely, if imperfectly, as could be done. And if there were finer plays than our winner and two runners-up in the 478 plays that I did not read, my congratulations to them. They're obviously extraordinary playwrights, and their time will come. Now to the chase. What standards did I employ in judging the plays I read? Well, the predictable, of course. Have I read this play before? Interesting how often borrowings are from minor plays, by the way. Can I read to the end of it without losing consciousness? How often I'd refresh myself, you know, coffee perhaps, stand up, walk around. Am I learning anything from this play, and anything provocative and illuminating, that is? And are the questions the play poses sufficiently interesting to warrant the paucity of answers provided? Often, perhaps oddly, the questions are almost always more interesting than the answers provided. In theory, at least, a play of only questions can be profoundly moving. Does this play stretch my mind, open vistas of yet unexplored dramatic concepts? Well, that doesn't happen very often, does it? And when it does, we are grateful beyond thanks. Is this play just so good at what it does that we're almost tricked into thinking it matters? Is this absolutely chaotic and anti-dramatic mess of a play really as exciting, as good as it seems? And so on. The plays submitted to me ran the gamut, of course. Some were tiresome retreads. Some indicated no intuitive understanding of dramatic structure. Some were really essays in borrowed clothing. Two were laughable in their efforts to be shocking. Some others were intelligent and sincere, but hampered by their belief that playwriting ended with Middle Ibsen. A few were all emotion and nothing else. A few were hobbled by crippling mammotisms. And some by intended, I wonder, stylelessness. And some, the majority were, okay, if hardly exceptional. The Boys from Siam by John Connolly, the winner, by the way, is a big, sprawling novel of a play, swinging back and forth between tight scenes of beautifully characterized engagement and bravura episodes, taking big chances along the way, unhesitatingly assuming it knows what it's doing, which is almost always, and making us care, really care. Put this all together, and you have a winner. You have The Boys of Siam, about a pair of identical twins. When I was 16, I read a novel called Memoirs of a Midget by the British post-Victorian poet Walter de la Mare, which was exactly what its title proclaimed it to be, Memoirs of a Midget. Around the same time, I saw the extraordinary German film Freaks, which was harryingly also about its title, Freaks. These fascinated me, and it was a few years later, the more I read, the more I saw, that I realized that writers are attracted to the extraordinary for its dramatic intensity and endless possibility, and we're equally attracted to the unextraordinary for the same reasons. We write about the doomed, the damned, the lost, the afflicted, first because we care about them, and then because they are really fine dramatic subject matter. 4 years ago, I began a play about, among other things, identical twins. Critics remind me, by the way, it's a subject I've treated often and variously, the young man in my early play, The American Dream, for example. My play, Me, Myself, and I, is heading toward production right now, as I talk. Was I surprised when I realized that in The Boys from Siam, I was reading a play about Siamese twins, as they are almost always incorrectly called? Of course not. What a subject, huh? It did cross my mind that a few sour or careless minds might conclude that I was swayed toward The Boys from Siam by its subject matter, just as a few others might think I should have denied the play its due for the same reason. But there are only, what, 7 plots and 27 subplots available to us, and fertile minds like rich soil. Nope. I gave the prize to Mr. Connolly because I found his play to be the best of the bunch. Mr. Connolly, congratulations.
What a pleasure. On this evening, I would like to thank my wife, Margaret. Many years ago, I gave up work for a year to write a great novel. And to my great surprise, Margaret unhesitatingly supported this. My 5 children were very small at the time, and I don't know how they enjoyed starving for the year. But since then, Margaret has continued to support me, mostly with her sense of belief. So on such a night as this, I am happy to dedicate to Margaret The Boys from Siam. The Yale Drama Series, in a sense, because I'm a writer, struck me as akin to a play, the birth of something new, probably a 3-actor. And all plays have a backstory. And the backstory here, I think, is the intertwining of art with those who are great and wealthy and wise, those who are patrons of the arts, because these wise people understand that art is essential to civilization and to our society as it is. And in this play that I see the drama series to be, the great actor, of course, is Mrs. Francine Horne, because she conceived the notion of the play and established the David Charles Horne Foundation, and then went to Yale in order to develop an entity that would in some way commemorate her late and much-loved husband, who had this enormous interest in all things literary. And I think they were extremely fortunate in meeting with John Kulka as representative of Yale in his position as senior editor of the Yale Press, Yale University Press. And John, together with his assistant, Lindsay Toland, have carried me from the announcement of the win when they telephoned me up to this particular time. I think John has a slightly wry sense of humour. I came home one day and found there was a telephone call had been made from, it just said Yale University, and gave a number. And I said, well, that's very nice. Somebody's rung to tell me that thank you for the entry, but you didn't do very well. Please apply next year. So I said I'd ring tomorrow. And tomorrow another telephone came, call much the same, and I said, well, that's very interesting, maybe I've been long listed, and I'll ring tomorrow. And tomorrow came, and this time there was a rather more demanding phone call saying John Kulka had rung from Yale University Press. So my heart began to thump a little bit, and I rang John, and he said, I'm John Kulka, I'm ringing about the Yale drama series. And he said, I have what I hope you'll consider to be good news. So I said, well, that's my short list gone to long list again. And with a great sense of drama, he simply said, Mr. Albee has chosen the boys from Siam. So I'm going to get my own back on them at some stage. John, anyway, brought this whole thing through its embryonic stages and towards delivery. And as Mr. Albee has said, the most important people at one level here have been the readers who selected the final list for him to read. And I see these as the midwives. And obviously, every birth of something new requires an obstetrician. And in this case, the great obstetrician is Edward. So I have to add a small coda to this. Obviously, I want to thank Yale Repertory Theatre, who will go on to perform a stage rehearsal of the work, and Yale University Press, who, as you know, will publish it in its own time. The small coda is, over the 18 months it took to write this work, these twins grew from a very vague notion into three-dimensional people who came to inhabit my head day and night. They lived with me. They became more real than many people in my world. And of course, they've accompanied me tonight. And in this coda, what they've said to me is they have a thank you to say to the two people whom they believe to be primus inter pares, first among equals. And the words they have to say are, Mr. Albee, you're a prince, and Mrs. Horn, you're a princess. Thank you.
This is for the midget. I'm overwhelmed with joy and gratitude, and at the same time, totally inhibited being in the presence of these very special wordsmen that express so perfectly what me as a mere mortal would like to say. So forgive me if I ramble on. I must correct one thing. I am not the donor. I am the recipient, and I'm the recipient for life. A receiver of a future for generations to come in the name of my husband, David Horn. I have been given the opportunity of providing to an unknown talent a chance to be heard, a chance to be seen and read, to follow his or her dream, and at the same time, I hope, regenerate the theater. David's dream was to be published. He was 12 times a year. For 25 years, we produced an international fashion publication called Here and There. It made an industry that only looked at pictures and spoke a funny kind of, not exactly English, read. It was intelligent and, of course, out of step with its audience. But that was not enough for him. He stole days and work nights writing a play, a children's book, and finally, at 62, he started a novel. Cancer took away his dream just as he was starting his second novel. He was never published. For those that may be curious regarding the genesis of the foundation, it was quick, simple, hatched in 30 minutes. My Lancelots, Robert Balsam and Alfred Goldfield, they really are my lawyers that send bills, asked me what I want to do in the future with my money. What money? It's not that much. After death or before death. Anyway, the idea was hatched. It was preferable pre-death. It seemed a better choice. At least I get a dinner. Alfred put me in touch with Yale, his alma mater. Alfred always has connections. Second phase, here came the snails. I was introduced to John Kolker, the senior editor at Yale University Press. He repositioned the award concept from novelist to playwright. John was totally supportive and surprised that I wasn't this dotty old dowager. That was then. I still probably am dotty. I was delighted he wasn't this intimidating, crusty old academic that would intimidate me. But we moved on. He is still positioning me, but he isn't crusty or old. but quite intimidating. John Donatich signed on without a struggle and helped us in every way. Every way to, where is the next page? The fingers don't work so well. In every way to make this happen. Yale rep came on board. Thank you, Mr. Bundy. Then the board came on board, and what a board they put together. This is where the snails come in. Contracts took 2 years. Then the Christmas gift to end all gifts arrived. Mr. Albee said yes. God said yes. The doyen of the theater said yes. He will do it. He will be our judge. And what a judgment he made. He gave us Mr. Conley. He gave us the boys from Siam, a special author that combines his love of prose with poetry, his depth of questioning the whys of life, God, deformity, curiosity, attachment, love, and death. Were questions we all have, but Mr. Conley's imaginative context was intriguing. Even the names of the characters gripped you. I smiled with those names. On a very personal note, thank you, Mr. Albee, as your very first choice could have not been better. David loved writing and dedicated himself to the written word in all forms. He broke away in his 60s. He too was from the other side of the pond. And thank you, Mr. Conley, for sending us your wonderful work. And by the way, thank you, Robert, for arranging this wonderful party. And thank you all for coming and enjoying this with us. And Gracie was a good girl.
I know I speak for the press to say that we're all tremendously moved by this opportunity. We're very lucky to announce also that Mr. Albee has agreed to judge next year's contest. So we'll hopefully be involved with producing the great playwrights of the next century. So please drink, enjoy, and thank you, Mrs. Horn, Mr. Albee, congratulations, Mr. Connolly.